Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we introduce today's guest, I want to be sure that we thank our sponsor, OneCause. OneCause is the leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I would also like to tell you about Responsive's 12-month recovery plan that we've been collaborating on for the last several weeks with several of our most trusted colleagues in the fundraising space. We are very grateful to Jennifer Harris, Andrew Olson, Teresa Lee, as well as our friends at OneCause and iWave for contributing to this plan. This resource is available to you for free. All you have to do is go to our website at www.responsivefundraising.com/recovery plan and download it. I will also be sure to include a link in the show notes. Now let's introduce today's guest. Hi, Stephen. It's a delight to have you on the podcast with me this morning. Before we dive into our conversation, why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes, thank you very much, Jason. My name is Stephen Burns. I am the Director of Advancement at Lansdale Catholic High School. We are a co-ed Catholic high school, a member of the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Very excited to be here today.
Yeah, Stephen. So I think you and I met, you were in one of our seminars about a year ago. Am I right?
Correct. I think it was about 2 years ago, actually. It was at the Greater YMCA, Greater Philadelphia YMCA.
Yes, I remember that. It was a kind of a cold, maybe slightly dreary afternoon or morning, and we had a good time. It was a small group, but I certainly enjoyed that. Glad that you were there. As I was reading through your notes yesterday, for our conversation, I did not realize that the Catholic schools had such a history in Philadelphia that, in fact, you guys are the first and oldest system, perhaps, in the United States. Is that am I recalling that correctly from your notes?
Yes, that is correct. And you know, it's something that we talk about a lot here, and there's a lot of pride in the system. We've undergone an insane amount of changes over those hundreds of years that we've been around. But, you know, we are home to the oldest Catholic school system in the country. So that is something that that we draw a lot of pride from.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I recall doing when I was in education myself, I remember doing some research on the start of the schools. And I remember Philadelphia coming up quite a bit in my research. So I'm starting to sort of piece all that memory together. So I can certainly appreciate that.
Glad
Stephen,
I can help you out.
You said in the notes that COVID-19 was sort of helping you stir up mixed feelings in response to, or as a result, as you think about technology and how it applies to fundraising. And I tend to think that you and I are probably going to be on the same page. But rather than me putting words in your mouth, how about you tell me what your thoughts are on that?
Sure. Thank you. So, you know, I'm not as seasoned a veteran in the fundraising world as you or some of your guests may have been. I'm just about to complete my 8th year as a professional fundraiser. I did some things here and there, you know, growing up, some volunteer work, but, you know, nothing substantial. But, you know, when I first got into fundraising, I was in charge of, you know, the annual fund and you know, alumni relations and database management. And a lot of my training, I mean, a substantial amount of my training was using tools, was using, you know, prospect research tools and crowdfunding tools and, you know, mastering, you know, the Razor's Edge database. And it was a lot of me sitting in front of a computer and kind of learning how to use all these, you know, toys and tools that were put at my disposal. And, you know, which was great. And I, you know, I didn't know anything about fundraising, really. I kind of fell into this, my first job here, and then kind of fell in love with it. But there was so much training and so much time put into learning all these different technologies. And then after I was in for about 4 or 5 years, I was having a conversation with my dad, who was a lifetime salesman, and he was asking me what sort of kind of sales training that I had had or that I had gotten from my job. And I realized that I didn't really have any, which, yeah. You know, and his kind of point of view was, you know, not being a fundraiser was, well, you know, you're basically a salesman, you're selling the school and you're selling the school to people for their support. And he's like, you know, from his perspective, the training that he had and the start of his professional career, you know, and obviously it's a different era, but it was all about how to have a conversation with someone and how to read their responses and how to read the room and how to keep a conversation going and how to respond to no in the different ways. And I realized that I had so much more training on you know, the tools and the toys that I had on the actual, you know, the sale or the ask, if you will, that I kind of, you know, started to peel back. And I was like, you know what, I'm not really sure, you know, this technology, while it's great in perhaps a big shop where you might have 15 or 20 people, you might have someone designated to just sit in front of a computer and do research for you. I feel like I was, myself and some other people were kind of getting blinded by the, oh, you know, you could find this donor who has $1 million and maybe he'll give it to you. And, oh, this is great. Let's find out what country club he's a part of and this and that. And we'd spend hours building these dossiers on people, but, you know, we never had a chance to talk to him. And it was like, you know, I don't want to say it was wasted time, but it was that we were taught how to use the tools, but maybe not the other side of it, which was then, okay, now that you know how to do this tool, how do you incorporate this tool into actually using it to build a relationship with the donor and getting their support? That was kind of a lost piece. And I definitely fell into the trap of, you know, being a, you know, 25-year-old kid. I was way more comfortable researching Jason Lewis for 5 hours than I was picking up the phone and calling him.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I was never, I don't mean to, you know, disparage anyone in the system who was giving me the training. But I didn't get the nudge to actually then use this information and jump into the deep end with it. So it was easy for me as kind of a green fundraiser here to just kind of hide behind the technology that I had at my fingertips and kind of think that I was doing all this great work when in fact I was kind of treading water for a while. So I actually, you know, like I said, I had that conversation with my father. And then shortly after that, I as you mentioned earlier, I met you at the Greater Philadelphia YMCA. And I actually asked this question about donor research. I'm sure you don't remember this, but I asked the question about donor research and your response was, well, that's great that you can do all those things, but you might've saved yourself a lot of time if you had first called that person and, you know, see if they'd want to have a cup of coffee first.
Yeah.
If the answer was no, if the answer was, please don't ever call me again, you didn't have to do 4 hours of research on that person. So, you know, it was kind of like, oh man, it's like, you know, not that I was wasting time, but once again, the focus wasn't something that you harp on all the time. It was, there was just all these additional technologies that were coming out for crowdfunding and for, you know, all this other stuff. It was all your favorite phrase at this arm's length. And it was kind of giving me reasons to stay away from the donor as opposed to giving me reasons to go closer to the donor. So that's kind of where I was. And then, you know, this COVID crisis happens. And so back up a step, not that I had a disdain toward toward technology, but then every time, you know, somebody would call me or I'd be at a conference or something and someone would be trying to sell some new database or some new research tool, I'd be like, oh my God, you know, enough of this crap. That's not what I need. It's not what I need. So I almost had this kind of like, you know, I was looking down on that type of thing, on technology and how it was kind of stunting my growth, I think, at the start of my career. But then, you know, this COVID happened and I'm at home, I've got three young children. So I'm trying to do all my work from home. And my first thought when I'm like, how am I possibly going to be able to sustain my work, going to, you know, grow my support base for my school? But then I'm like, all this other technology is being highlighted, you know, like Zoom and being able to hop on different webinars and do these things. And I'm finding a newfound love of the technology at my fingertips that's actually allowing me to get closer to the donor and to kind of have these interactions that are way more meaningful than they were a few months ago. So like I said, it's kind of my mixed feelings of, you know, this technology. I think some of it's good, but it can definitely keep you away from, I think, the goal of the job, but, you know, can distract you. And it was on me. I mean, it was my own lack of discipline and lack of knowledge to learn that this tool is just a tool to do a job. You know, there's another step after you use the tool.
Yes.
Eventually you have to take that other step. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that has fallen in that trap of not taking that other step, but, you know, it was kind of in my way. And now I'm finding a newfound reliance on the technology to kind of, get closer to some people who I'm otherwise unable to do so. So that's kind of where I am in a nutshell on my feelings of technology and fundraising right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. I always get the benefit of sort of listening to people. I've become a much better listener as I listen to people on this side. Some of us fundraisers aren't the best listeners. We are pretty chatty. but as I'm listening to you, the two words that sort of come to mind the most is your use of the word trapped. And the notion of hiding. And I think that's what, and then it also occurs to me, if I'm correct, yeah, you've earned your CFRE in the 8 years you've been doing this, you're already wearing a CFRE on your name, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Yeah. And so what interests me is how much of that, for example, CFRE, were you able to achieve still while you were trapped or hiding behind technology, and was in fact that credential ensuring that you were actually learning the things that that you're getting at, you know, or do we have a credentialing process that is perhaps somewhat flawed because it elevates or it rewards the very thing that you're acknowledging isn't so helpful. Is sort of that.
Yeah. Well, at the risk of career suicide on your podcast here, Jason. excuse me. I would have to agree with you.
Yeah.
That the technology, the hours and hours that I spent doing training classes strictly so that I could hit enough credits to qualify to take the CFRE, I would be lying if I said my undivided attention was given to each three-hour session that I participated in order to get the credits. You know, so yes, I definitely leaned on my access to technology, my access to online classes.
And I won't be so, I have no desire for redefining the CFRE credentialing process, but if I was in charge of it and I said you had to accomplish, you had to sit across the lunch table from a, a donor a minimum of 100 times. Would you have had that when you applied for the CFRE?
No way. No chance.
Right. No chance. See, so whatever that number is, and I'm not saying that the only, plenty of my critics would say that I narrow it down to the lunch table, too often, but in truth, that's essentially the advice your dad was giving you too. Your dad was saying, how many times have you essentially been to the lunch table and had a meaningful conversation with an individual that eventually closed a sale?
Yes, and, exactly.
That's what he was basically saying. But what he was also saying, and again, some of my critics are going to think that we're sort of hinging this on the notion that fundraising is sales. But what your dad's advice was is not that fundraising and sales are the same thing, but in fact that experience or expertise is off in a lot of fields is actually gained by doing more than it is by learning. So it's the field work that we do that needs to be quote unquote credentialed more than it is the absorption of knowledge, the classroom time, like to think about the way education gets done. And we talk about this in education all the time as well. What value is there that can be presented in a classroom, textbook, behind a laptop sort of setting versus what types of skills, like your dad was suggesting, can only be learned by being in the field. And I think we have and you may have even heard me say this at some point or another, and I've certainly said this on the podcast, I think we have a lot of CFREs running around that don't know how to take anybody out to lunch. And that's my biggest sort of hang up about the fundraising profession. And that's why I call it that's why I say it's in its messy adolescence, because it hasn't grown up to the point where it recognizes that the things that we learn, it's not technology. And at the most, it's perhaps what Peter Thiel in his book calls complementary technology. There's a difference between the technology that you were using pre-COVID or when you were coming to this, when you were in this sort of realization that technology might be something you were hiding behind versus the technology you're using now. The technology you're using now, when you refer to it like Zoom, is complementary to you engaging with a donor.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's totally different. The technology as the umbrella is the umbrella statement. Is technology helping or hurting me? But yeah,
right.
To drill down, there are certain technologies that before I was using, to hide behind. But now it's enabling me to open more doors and have more meaningful conversations with people, and definitely act, as a complementary technology, as you were saying, to kind of. Help get with those donors.
Thiel calls it, Thiel in his book, Zero to One is the name of the book. Thiel talks about we've got to get technology right so that it helps human behavior or human endeavors rather than letting technology sort of do the work for us. And he uses the word competitive technologies versus complementary technologies, I think is the way he phrases that. But it's the idea that if you're fascinated, and I think this is part of the problem that I think a lot of fundraising professionals, I'm not speaking of your experience, I think you've sort of had one of those come to Jesus moments where you're realizing, okay, something's gotten in my way. But I still think we have a lot. I think there's people who have a decade or two more experience than you do. And these are the people that don't like some of the stuff that I talk about on here. I think there's people who have decades more experience than you do, Stephen, that are still hiding behind that technology, and they'd love to say that they're experts. And I would say to them in a moment, I would say immediately to them, look, technology is going to basically take over your job because you've basically just been fascinated with what technology can do. Eventually, we're not going to need you to begin with. your dad's advice was, sure, use technology, but let's sure as heck make sure that there's something you're developing that technology actually can't do instead of you doing it.
Yes, absolutely. And what I referenced too is a lot of things he would talk about is, you know, when you're in the middle of a conversation with someone, you have to be able to, you know, hear what they're saying, but more importantly, you have to hear what they're meaning by from what they're saying and how they're saying it. And that, you know, you can't necessarily learn that from a webinar, and you can get tips from that. But as you had mentioned before, until you spend time in the field and, you know, quote unquote, taking people out to lunch and kind of taking your lumps and realizing, wow, I played that one wrong. That's a huge, I mean, that to me, just from my own personal experience, I have learned way more and grown way more from stepping out there and but my boss isn't listening and kind of blowing a meeting than I have necessarily from, you know, doing hours of training behind a computer screen to kind of, you know, in the off chance that I do meet that donor, you know, who lives in Virginia on a horse farm. That was my come to Jesus moment, you know, as you had referenced, kind of just taking that leap and getting out there and realizing what it's actually like to sit and talk with someone and build that relationship. So,
yeah, but if your boss know if your boss is a good boss, and I'm suspecting
he is a good boss.
He certainly is. they can appreciate that experience in the field, whether it ultimately is a quote unquote win or lose, whatever it is deemed, is the training experience. I mean, that is what, and as educators, you guys are educating children here, and you want to put these young people out into the world to be successful. And one of the things that in the educational world, we could be complete, we scrap fundraising from even the conversation for a moment. We need to completely understand that everything that can be taught cannot be taught behind a laptop or in a, you know, or even in a classroom. Everything is not just textbook information. It's not just, you know, sort of, but there are things that we have to learn by doing, and fundraising, just like your dad's business and being in sales, is the same thing. But you also have to learn it by failing, by screwing up. That meeting, I love to know, and again, this gets back to like the credentialing idea. If I was writing the qualifications for the CFRE and I said you have to do 100 lunch table conversations, I could care less what the outcomes of those 100 conversations were. I just want to know that you can get to the lunch table and that you can navigate that lunch table conversation for 35 minutes without, you know, totally freaking out and quitting on yourself. It's not really all that information, the well screening information. So when I was at the health charity in Washington, this was 15 years ago, when I was at the health charity, we were guilty of the same thing. So I was a new major gifts officer. This was my first major gift role. Prior to that, I had been in two small shop, you know, one person roles, like sort of like everyone lands in at some point or another.
Right.
And Danielle was newly experienced as a supervisor of major gift officers. And so I was her first, I was sort of her guinea pig. And so we were both learning what it meant to do major gift work at the same time. And she made the same mistake. And I followed that you would describe for yourself, that she paid me for that first, I don't know, 45 days, first 60 days, you know, a couple of months that I was in the job, she paid me to literally sit behind Wealth Engine or something and write up profiles on people as if that was actually raising money. And we realized within the first quarter of me being there that it wasn't getting us anywhere. It was all valid, accurate, useful information.
Right.
But ultimately, if the guy in Pittsburgh won't take a telephone call, and if you ultimately, in my case, because I was a traveling major gift officer, if he wouldn't take a meeting with me, what I knew of his, you know, ownership in Alcoa or anybody else didn't matter.
Exactly.
And so we came to the conclusion. So when I was in that role, I always maintained a portfolio of 100 donors. And so I always had 100 names on my list, and I always made the effort to, you know, 10 or 15 minutes worth of research before I picked up the phone. Danielle and I sort of figured this out ourselves, you know where this person lives, sort of know what their gift history is, know what the history with the organization is, things you could generally find in the organization's current database, not things you have to go hunting for anywhere else. Right. Then schedule the meeting. And then go and do the research once you have that meeting scheduled so that you, but even at that point, I don't know that we ever came to the conclusion that 4 hours, 4 hours is quite a bit of, but you know, the other thing, Steve, and I'll let you chime in here. What is it about I think some of it that we haven't owned up to, perhaps some of us have, I think you're owning up to it a little bit. And I'm going to get you to own up to it, is the fascination with it. It's the idea that you can put somebody's name, somebody you don't know, into a database, find out that they're not worth, you know, hundreds of thousands or even millions, but perhaps they're even worth billions. And to even think that we could get so close to that, these are people that, you know, with affluence and means that a lot of us in these fundraising roles have never had or never been close to. And so I think in some ways, some of the technology is just so fascinating that it's almost irresistible. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as a young, once again, you know, reference to when I was kind of first getting into this role, you know, I'm 25 years old and just the thought of, oh man, this guy's worth millions and millions of dollars. And if I get this, then, it was like euphoric just to think and kind of dream of how this would happen. Now it never happened, but it didn't stop me from almost daydreaming about it and digging deeper, you know, and I would find someone and it would say something and I'm like, oh, but what if this? And I would keep digging and digging and digging in the hopes that I would, you know, find that kind of golden goose that would be able to, you know, oh, I'm going to give $10 million to the school because Stephen found me on Wealth Engine. but yeah, it was absolutely fascinating on what you could find on people. And you could, you know, it sounds creepy, but, you know, you could find out where they lived and you could Zillow their house and you could see the footprint of their mansion that they lived in. And you could say, oh, my goodness, look at, you know, the life that this man or woman or this couple has. And it was hard to not be distracted by it. It was hard to not sit there and kind of salivate on the possibility that that this person, you know, that their success could kind of help your success as a professional. But once again, that's assuming that I would have then made the next step and actually picked up the phone, which at the time, as you said, you're going to get me to own up to it. At the time, I didn't do that. Yeah. So all it was kind of hoping and dreaming and kind of living and looking at their data sheet and kind of saying how amazing this person is. And, you know, as a kid, basically that I was at the time, it was. I would, you know, I'm daydreaming about it, as opposed to kind of figuring out how to apply it to succeeding in the role that I had at the time.
Well, you know, and this is a fascination of the work that I do by having these conversations with guys. In some ways, this is field research for me as I'm working. I'm currently working on my second book and. I've never sort of pieced it together, this thought, but if you think about what you just said, Stephen, it's the information that oftentimes comes out of that database that this person is, you know, whatever he or she is and however much wealth they have or the boards that they sit on. Oftentimes I have to imagine, I guess I can't say with complete, confidence that this is what happens, but I'm sure a psychologist can sort of explain why this might be. The idea that the very information that you just pulled out of that system is perhaps part of the reason that it's so difficult to now pick up the phone. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because what that system basically just did is that system convinced you that this person is so different and so not who you are. Mm-hmm. And so many light years away from what you currently understand, that perhaps picking up the telephone and just having a normal conversation with this guy or this gal isn't all that possible because they're not like you or something.
It almost dehumanizes them.
Yeah. Well, it extra humanizes. It makes them so alien to who you are. I do know that there are studies that explain why fundraisers are oftentimes more inclined to study people to solicit donors for whom they can identify with and for whom they have interacted with and therefore received some sort of signal from the donor that I like you or I approve of you than those donors who don't or haven't. And when you're sitting there, looking at this individual on this database who looks like he or she lives literally on another planet than you do, there's no common ground there.
Yeah. Where do you even begin? Unless you're used to that, which at the time I was not.
You weren't,
Having no experience, virtually no experience doing that to kind of jump into that level. What it boils down to is I was too scared to make the call. And I never thought of it that way, but it's as much as the information that I gathered was exciting and it was like titillating to think about. Right. It's probably the exact reason that one of the exact reasons that I didn't pick up the phone, almost for fear of blowing it. I don't know, for fear of this elephant of a donor. And I couldn't even get him to answer the phone. I blew it, or just not even being able to relate to them at all. I'm not sure, but that's an interesting thought. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I haven't either, but I'm sure it's built in that. So one of the things that we're talking about in sort of philanthropic circles right now, I have not been terribly actively involved in these conversations, but I know these conversations are being had. And that is how do we engage donors who don't look like the stereotypical donor? So how do we get more non-white male, non-white straight male donors who do exist out there? There are plenty of non-white straight male people out there who have means, who can give to our organizations. But oftentimes, because we see that individual as sort of the stereotypical donor, we therefore sort of get trapped in the notion that that's who our donor is and anybody else doesn't look like that. Well, in some ways, those systems probably create some of that stereotyping and encourage some of that. And I had an African American woman, for example, working for me at the school that I ran here in York, who met with some of my students recently at the college. And she was talking about how she has had to make a deliberate effort to pursue donors who don't look like the stereotypical donor in our community. In our community here, we have a lucky list of 10 or 12 individuals who give to most things, and they give they're the people that show up on all those wealth engine reports in extraordinary ways, but they're all straight white men. They don't fit any other profile. And there is other wealth in this community. It's just we have to be convinced that it's out there and we have to go looking for it. And so, in this new book project that I'm working on right now, Stephen. And I think, again, this gets back to kind of what your dad was getting at about your sales training, his sales training. I think fundraisers have got to be more, they have to have what one author calls the sort of the passion of an explorer. And that is, we have to, if you think about what an explorer does when he or she sort of lands in the jungle, they don't know exactly what it is they're going to look for. And they certainly are not, they're in a very unfamiliar place, but they know how to navigate this uncharted territory. And they generally get very surprised when they find something remarkable. And I think that's some of the stuff that's missing in our fundraising training, is that we haven't trained you up, Stephen, to be an explorer, to pursue particular types of donors. We're just feeding you information that says go. So even at the point that you do get comfortable at the lunch table, you're still sitting in front of donors who you're comfortable with.
At this point,
does that make sense?
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned the explorer. The way my father put it is that he was a lifelong athlete. He always he would refer to it as, he would try to make it a game and try to make it a competition. And he enjoyed the competition of getting them to accept the call and getting to the table and kind of, the back and forth of it all. In his case in sales, I would say it was more of kind of a victory of getting the sale. I wouldn't call getting the donor to donate to your school necessarily, a victory. That sounds too one-sided, but that same thing, that kind of, you would say explore. I would say I kind of like the competition of it all, and like the, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, but, that unknown of how to get there and how to work the relationship and work the lunch table. So you get to a point where you and a donor kind of have a mutual success, is exciting. And that's something I didn't get that at the start of my career. That kind of experience.
I've been studying this concept of, serendipity. So serendipity is the idea. It's this notion of exploring and being surprised. It's sort of a combination of things that essentially you arrive at a very fortunate outcome that you totally didn't expect to get to. And I don't think that there's enough in our desire for predictable outcomes in fundraising, just like in fundraising, certainly not the only industry that's guilty of this. We have basically scrapped all the possibility or a lot of the possibility for serendipity. And what your father learned as a salesman, and what I've learned in fundraising, and this is what you're sort of itching for as you describe your aspirations in the future, and perhaps you've certainly experienced this to some degree, is you want those very serendipitous moments where you're sitting across the lunch table and what you thought the opportunity was has just gone exponentially somewhere where you didn't even see it coming. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You want to be so surprised. You're getting together with this guy for to ask this individual for $50,000, and you just found out that he or she wants to give you $1 million, and they're ready to unload that cash like tomorrow. That's where those people who learn how to get out into the field and learn how to have that passion of that, that explorer, who perhaps are doing like you're describing, sort of competing with themselves to how often can I push myself out the door, are also those people who've learned that a lot of the work is just getting out the door and constantly sort of searching for that next opportunity that more than likely Wealth Engine's not going to tell us exists. Wealth Engine at most is perhaps going to better inform, or enlighten us, but very rarely does it actually, reveal the gold, if you will.
Right.
It's not a treasure map.
Yeah. I definitely think, I don't mean to disparage, it has value, it has worth, just, you know, when used properly. And that, you know, requires some kind of self-awareness and self-discipline to, you know, to use it, you know, just as a tool and be able to take that, take the next step.
Oh yeah. There's companies. So we work with, so Responsive, we work with iWave. iWave is a wealth screening company. And then there's a CRM company that, Virtuous, that's out in Arizona that we've done a lot of conversations with and we recommend to our clients and so forth. And these are companies that I think are realizing some of the inherent flaws in how fundraisers, you're not really talking about the flaws in the technology. You're talking about the flaws in the way that fundraisers are trained to use them.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so what I think some of these, in the case of iWave with their well screening software, and in the case of Virtuous, which is a CRM platform, what they're realizing is that they can design and sell their product to users in ways that perhaps ensure that the fundraiser uses them in the most healthy way. Because if all you're about doing is essentially exploiting value, which is a lot of what these systems are ultimately designed to do, is just extract and exploit value from other human beings. You know, the fundraiser ultimately learns very little. And the relationship doesn't go anywhere. And, Stephen, you've been in those moments. You have to have been in one of those moments where you secure that gift, but you haven't added enough to the relationship and the process of securing that gift that you can even get that meeting again. Have you been there?
Oh, I've absolutely been there. And
yeah,
that's
part of the problem with that database, because that database is essentially signaled to you that we have all the information and that you can't add anything to it. And so, you know, it's one thing for you to secure a $100,000 gift from that donor. It's another thing to know, and this is what your boss is the most concerned about, is can Steven actually get back to the lunch table in 3 weeks to appropriately acknowledge that gift and begin the journey of securing that same gift or a larger gift next year.
Yeah. And I also think there's a level of understanding that you need to have, you know, as the major gift officer, where, you know, did this donor just give you $10,000 because you did an amazing job, or did he give you $10,000 so that you could go away and he didn't feel bad about it? You know what I mean? Which I think is a reality. And especially as a young, you know, and I don't mean to keep saying this, but as a younger person who's early in his career, you know, it's great. Come home from a lunch meeting and say, boss, I got 10 grand today. It was excellent. But, you know, if your 10 grand really could have been 100 grand, you didn't do yourself any favors. And like you said, the donor didn't see enough, you know, in that lunch conversation where he was willing to give you a meaningful donation. And as you mentioned, probably, you know, grow the relationship and come back to the lunch table next year when it comes time to give again. And kind of being able to recognize that is another skill, you know, that experience is going to teach you.
Yeah, I probably told this story. It was the moment at which I learned the lesson that you've learned, that I think it really set in. And I actually went home with a $25,000 commitment, but I had gone up to New York City and gotten on the trains that go north of New York City, up along the Hudson River. And I get off the train and I meet this donor. She and I meet at a coffee shop that's literally sitting right there near the train station. And I solicited the gift so quickly and she said yes so quickly that I was able to actually catch the next southbound train to get back to New York City so I could head back home. I don't think I was sitting there with her for more than a half hour. And what I realized in time as I got to know this donor is that there were I got a $25,000 gift. I went home. I looked like a rock star to my employer, but the opportunities that were there was exponentially more to be had, right, for me and for the donor, and most importantly for the organization I was representing. But when you do your work so efficiently, sometimes you totally miss that stuff. And I mean, she said yes so quickly. It was like in her mind, it was like, if he says 25 or whatever number, if he says enough, you know, she knew what I was doing.
Right.
And the opportunity was there for, I figured out later that the opportunity was missed on my part to actually figure out how to have a meaningful relationship with this individual on behalf of my employer. Stephen, we could keep going for a long time, but we lose our listeners at about 40, 45 minutes. So if somebody, I'm sure we've both said enough to provoke some of our listeners to have some opinions as well. If somebody wants to reach out to you, how would you suggest that they do that?
I would say email is probably the best way. I can be reached at S Burns, that's S-B-U-R-N-S, at LansdaleCatholic.com. And I'm always happy to talk to a fellow colleague and engage in a conversation, hear some other viewpoints, some suggestions, some war stories to make me feel like I'm not the only one who's tried and failed out there. But yeah, always happy to engage in a conversation with anyone. So
thank you, Stephen. It's been a pleasure to have you on. You're always welcome back.
Thank you, Jason. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.